This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, March 17th. I'm Evan Osnos, staff writer at The New Yorker, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. This week, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson broke with a longstanding tradition by setting off on a major foreign trip, in this case to Asia, at a moment of high tension with North Korea, without allowing the diplomatic press pool to come along. He chose only one reporter to join him on his plane, a 33-year-old journalist from the Independent Journal Review, a conservative website geared for millennials, which was founded in 2012. At a press briefing on Wednesday, State Department spokesman Mark Toner defended the decision.
I can say going forward that every effort will be made to accommodate a press contingent on board the plane. But in this specific trip, instance, it was decided to take to make an outside the box, if I could put it that way, decision to bring somebody in who doesn't necessarily cover the State Department, a media outlet that isn't steeped in foreign policy.
Andrew Marantz joins me to discuss the escalating war between the American press and the Trump administration, and whether it's as threatening to democracy as some observers fear. Thanks for being here, Andrew. For 2 months now, we've watched the administration abandon one convention after another when it comes to its relationship with the press. This week, you published a piece in the magazine called Trolling the Press Corps. So help us make some sense of this, if you would. Is the administration, as it says, thinking outside the box, or is it trolling the press? And for that matter, really, what's the difference between the two?
I do think it's a little bit of both. I think... You know, the stated aim of bringing in new voices, democratizing the press corps, opening up to new media outlets, internet-savvy media outlets, those are all good on paper, and to some extent that is genuinely what's going on. I think at the same time, there is something else going on, which is, you know, I use the word trolling. I don't know if that word is in the dictionary yet, but the definition that I know is doing something or saying something in order to get a specific reaction from people. And that is certainly an aspect of what's going on too, because, you know, the press can always be relied upon to react to any slights with wounded egos and pious sermons about how, you know, the press is very important. And that is a good political plan for the Trump administration. By good, I mean effective, because everyone hates the mainstream press across the political spectrum. So if you can get the press talking in kind of wounded, highfalutin terms about how great they are, A, it's a distraction from whatever, you know, policy issues you don't want the press to be discussing, and B, it just makes everyone look at them with disdain, and then you have a foil against which you suddenly somehow look noble.
So let's look in more detail at what's actually changing at the moment. You spent time with the White House press corps. You went to briefings, and you described at one point that Press Secretary Sean Spicer calls on reporters now from little-known blogs, and he's also played around with the old rules that governed the way the White House press corps worked. And he's added a line of TV screens with reporters from news outlets around the country, and that has perhaps inevitably become known as the Skype seats. What else is going on? What's changing, and what really matters here?
What, one of the reporters in the room on Twitter referred to the Skype seats as the Skype-a-fants. people have worried that those questions tend to be, you know, a little bit soft, a little bit doting. Look, the larger frame of this, again, this is why this is so politically savvy on the part of the administration. There's no part of that that is A, in contravention of any law or rule. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that CBS has to be called on before the Daily Caller. The media is changing extremely quickly, and the notion that we can sort of wrinkle our nose at a web-first or a web-only media outlet is truly quaint and obsolete at this point. So it's very easy to frame this discussion as a bunch of pearl clutching and, you know, why are we even bothering to pay attention to the press? The press is not the story here. And I think the answer is, look, there is nothing wrong in principle with bringing in new voices. But what some of the people, some of the more seasoned correspondents told me when I was talking to people in that room one person said, I love geographic diversity. I love even ideological diversity. What I don't love is diversity of journalistic practice. And I think the notion that there is some value to being experienced, to having learned how to ask questions in a way that's more pointed and more likely to yield a meaningful answer. In a way, they seem kind of like old-fashioned values that in normal times we wouldn't have to talk about. But I think now just the basic notion that reporters should ask genuine, straightforward, tough questions is pretty directly being challenged by the administration. So I think that has become more of a focus and a source of concern for people in the room.
What's an example of one of these kind of softball questions that has been asked at a Trump press conference that comes to mind?
Well, the one that got a lot of attention, and I think it's an interesting one because there are two ways to look at it. So I was there on a week that started with a press conference with the president and a visiting head of state. So Trump was hosting Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada. They met in the Oval Office, and then they moved into the East Room to take questions from reporters. Trudeau called on two Canadian reporters, and Trump called on two American reporters. And this was a moment of high tension because the story of the day was Mike Flynn. And this was the moment, you know, it was a kind of textbook hold the president's feet to the fire moment, and the two outlets he called on were Sinclair Broadcasting, which was alleged to have made some quasi-nefarious deals with the Trump campaign, and then The Daily Caller. And the young woman from The Daily Caller stood up and basically said, Mr. President, what are the greatest national security issues facing our country? Which seemed to many people like a prototypical softball question. There was an uproar in the room. There were people tweeting during the press conference about how annoyed they were at this question. Annoyed is even too weak a word. People were outraged. And, you know, I talked to her the next day, and she made a defense for herself. She said, look, I'm not there to ask the same question that everybody else would have asked. If we're all interchangeable, then why are we all in the room? You know, I had a question I wanted to ask about national security. Maybe I could have phrased it differently, but I stand by the question. And you know, that really gets to the heart of these concerns. You know, I understand why people wanted her to ask about Flynn. Flynn was the story of the day. It's certainly what CNN or ABC or the AP would have asked about. But she asked about something different, and there is no rule that says she can't.
You know, oftentimes when we hear these kinds of intramural squabbles about the dynamics of the White House press corps, it can seem immaterial, except to those who say, well, no, these are the sort of small building blocks that constitute a democratic political culture, making sure that you have rigorous questioning of public officials, making sure that you do have real access for news organizations. And one of the things you highlighted in your story, which is really interesting, is this sort of underlying long-running dynamic. And you quoted Andrew Breitbart, of course, who was the founder of Breitbart, where Steve Bannon was the chairman. You quoted Breitbart writing in 2011, quote, the left wins because it controls the narrative. The narrative is controlled by the media. I am at war to gain back control of the American narrative, unquote. What does he mean by that? And frankly, has that happened?
I think he's on his way posthumously to achieving it. I don't think we're all the way there yet. He, like many, many figures on the extreme right, grew up in liberal, placid, in his case, Brentwood, Los Angeles. And it took him years before he pierced what he saw as that bubble of misinformation and started his conservative awakening. And I think when you have that personal awakening, it seems to you like there was a big conspiracy going on the whole time to keep you in the dark. At least this is the narrative, the personal narrative that Andrew Breitbart describes in his memoir. His goal was to discredit the power that these organizations had over the minds and hearts of the average American and to move us as far away as possible from the Walter Cronkite days when if you saw a man in a suit saying something on television, you assumed it must be true. Andrew Breitbart's vision and the vision of a lot of other people who were in that movement with him, including Steve Bannon, was to turn that on its head, to say, if the suits on the mainstream media are saying it, that's how you know it's not true. And I think that the heirs to that strategy, Steve Bannon being most visible among them, have made an enormous amount of progress. And by the way, they found a perfect fellow traveler in Donald Trump, who has always had what I call in the piece a codependent relationship with the media. You know, he needs them. He loves the attention. He feeds off it. He makes money off it. And yet if there's ever a critical word about him in the press, he freaks out and feels personally insulted. So you have in Donald Trump this mix of, I think, genuine aggrievement and then a more strategic thing going on where he says, okay, if I can turn this into a referendum on the trustworthiness of the guy wearing the suit behind the desk, then I kind of have a blank check where I can spin and say things that are self-contradictory and say things without any evidence behind them. Trump says something, the media says he's lying, and then Trump can turn to his base and say, who do you choose to believe?
In your piece, you follow one of these new arrivals in the press corps, a sort of linear descendant of the Andrew Breitbart, Steve Bannon idea of journalism and its relation to politics. And the guy's name is Lucian Wintrich. He's a 28-year-old writer for a right-wing blog called The Gateway Pundit. Tell us a bit about Wintrich and what you discovered by following him around for a while.
Yeah, so Lucian, like some of the other people I was describing, started off as a kind of standard liberal. He went to Bard College, and at some point he, you know, saw through the matrix and said, I am now a Barry Goldwater conservative, and the way that I'm going to perpetuate my politics is by getting a rise out of people. This is a common thread around certain right-wing areas of the internet. The highest goal in some cases is to take a liberal snowflake and make them really upset and trigger them or whatever the terminology is. So Lucian is a specialist at this. He also likes triggering the snowflakes on the religious right. He's gay. He likes to take lots of photographs of young men that he calls his Twinks for Trump series, and he likes to put them up in the background at Republican events and sort of watch church ladies as they freak out and say, this is not my Republican Party.
So let me stop you right there for a second. Does he have an affirmative set of ideas? What is he driven actually by any political content?
He does have an ideology. His laptop has a huge decal on the back of it that says Goldwater in big, bold letters. So he has read The Conscience of a Conservative. He has read Reagan's memoirs. He's read Charles Murray. But he doesn't go into situations like the press briefing room and start arguing with people about tax policy. He doesn't think that is tactically the right way to approach it. He would rather shock you into paying attention to him and then maybe leading you down the road a little bit until you get to see what's motivating him and what the ideology is behind it. Now, obviously, it's polarizing and he loses a lot of people that way. But what he gains is a higher profile, and he gets people like me, for better or worse, to pay attention to him.
There's also an argument that by throwing up all the pieces in the air, that actually the Trump White House might be inadvertently altering the chemistry of the press corps in an interesting way, and perhaps even in a productive way, out of this what had become, I think, a kind of default setting of morally neutral, who's up, who's down coverage that was really dominating the campaign. It was one of the reasons why Trump got as far as he did. And let's listen just for a second to what has now become really an infamous clip from last February when Donald Trump called in to MSNBC's Morning Joe to speak with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski.
You guys have been supporters, and I really appreciate it. And not necessarily supporters, but at least believers. You said there's some potential there. And
okay. Well, I will tell you why. When you say supporter, you're talking about how actually there were a handful of people who for 6 months have been saying what happened last night could happen. and the rest of the media world has been
mocking, clarify what supporters has been mocking and ridiculing exactly what he's done.
Since then, we've heard some soul searching by members of the press about whether it did enough to scrutinize Trump's campaign or whether it did at times kind of amble into the position of being believers or supporters, as he put it. But did you sense that there is a real reassessment going on, that veteran political reporters are beginning to ask themselves whether this kind of morally desiccated approach of just covering the person with the biggest audience or the person who seems to be doing the sexiest or most outrageous thing on any given day is in fact the process that led to a White House that now has put them into this predicament?
This is difficult and in some cases even uncomfortable to talk about because we all like remaining on this very easy level of platitude where we can say the press's job is to tell the truth and the press's job is to report without fear or favor. Of course, that is true. But once you get beyond this simplistic and I think false notion that it's possible to get the unfiltered, unvarnished, unbiased truth, I don't think that's possible. I think that's just used as a cudgel in these kind of ideological debates where people go, your news is fake news. No, your news is biased. No, your news is filtered. Everything is going to be selected. Everything is going to be put in some context. So those things are now coming into sharper focus. I think now you can have a situation where the press secretary is so openly lying that it's in some cases literally laughable. There was a moment a few days ago when Sean Spicer was asked, okay, so before Trump was president, he said that the statistics that came out of the government about the unemployment rate were phony. And now that he is president and those statistics are favorable to him, he's saying they're true. Which one is it? And Spicer sort of said, yeah, they were fake then, but they're true now. Ha 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 ha. And everybody in the room started laughing. There was always spin. There was always lying. But now you just have a different kind of journalism. Now the opposition is a little bit clearer. Now the diverting of access journalism is a little bit clearer. And now those moral lines are having to be drawn in a way that they were never drawn explicitly before.
I think it's also worth noting here that in the midst of some of this fear and loathing, there is also some extraordinary journalism going on. I mean, there has been this resurgence of investigative reporting. There is a real feast of good work going on. And also on television, you've begun to see a very different posture from people like Jake Tapper on CNN, who is not shrinking away from the task of calling out lies. Where do you see this going, Andrew? Do you get the feeling that in the end, the press is going to be able to find a new path here? And is it finding a new path already?
I think that is fair and worth pointing out. And I also think it's worth pointing out that there are plenty of people from Fox News, from Fox Radio, from The Wall Street Journal, which is a Rupert Murdoch-owned publication. The so-called liberal media does not by any means have a monopoly on tough, groundbreaking reporting on the Trump administration. This is, you know, the my wife's joke is that everything these days has to be prefaced by the phrase now more than ever. But now more than ever, this is a time when journalism is self-evidently important. And I think journalists are, for the most part, doing a good job of taking advantage of that momentum. You know, this is an opportunity for institutions like CNN to, frankly, get some of their legitimacy back. And I think for the most part, mainstream organizations left, right, and center are doing a good job at that. Whether people are listening, watching, paying attention, whether it moves the needle, whether people care, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But I definitely do think that the sentiment that now is a good time to be a journalist and an important time to be a journalist is well taken, and I think people are proving that every day.
Andrew, thanks very much for coming on today. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Daniel Wenger. I'm Evan Osnos.